I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to All Stats Aren't We, a podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings-on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm Tom Woodhead, the Marcelo Bielsa of the podcast, bringing fresh new ideas to a team that, let's face it, has been crying out for them. And I'm joined by Tom Alderson, the Graham Potter of the podcast, young, urbane and ready for the next step. And finally, the Sam Allardyce of the podcast. You know what you're getting and you only have yourself to blame. It's John McKenzie. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, mate. It's very warm. So I've got my pint of wine in front of me. It's all good. And I know this is something that really winds you up, so I'm really going to go to town in it. So yeah, definitely a pint of wine in front of me.
I will hear no more about the pint of wine. How about you, Tom? How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. I think this is the first time I've been on a podcast that John hasn't hosted, so I feel like I'm meeting my new stepdad, but my dad's watching and it's all a little bit awkward.
Well, I'm not going to have to say Tom Alderson to you. I can just say good old-fashioned Tom, so that might help. So today we're going to be talking about tactics and going through various terms and ideas and concepts that people may or may not be aware of to give a sort of overview of the Leeds tactical landscape and the landscape of tactics in football in general to a certain extent. But before we get into that, just some news. Since we last recorded, Leeds have announced a couple more friendlies. We've got one against Real Betis on the 31st of July, which is the day after the Fleetwood game. So I would imagine it'll be another case of two separate 11s, as Bielsa likes to do, playing the majority of the 90 minutes for those two games, the Fleetwood and Betis games. And then we've got a prestige friendly with Ajax on the 4th of August, which should be presumably the first time that we'll see the likely starting lineup against Manchester United or something very close to it. So, Tom, how are you feeling about that, the Ajax game?
It's a shame that there's no fans there because I was going to suggest an All Stats Aren't We trip to Amsterdam, but that's out the window now. So, but yeah, that is good. Like compared to the friendlies we've had over, well, my time as a Leeds fan, it's just nice to have one against a big team. So I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, and like you said, it should be the first 11, so it'll give us a really good idea of how it's going to go for this season, hopefully.
What about you, John? You're a man who knows a lot about European football. Any thoughts on Leeds against Ajax?
Yeah, the Eredivisie in general, a bit of a blind spot for me. Josh Hobbs is the Eredivisie expert in this parish. But yeah, it should be an exciting game. Ajax obviously have a lot of decent players and they play a really fun brand of football. So I expect that to be a fun game. Although I did notice that there were some people suggesting that Ajax have a cup game maybe two or three days after they play us and their opening game in the season in I guess Bundesliga fashion, the Eredivisie must start its cup game or its cup run with the very opening game of the season. So whether or not we'll see a strong 11 from Ajax, I don't know. But is that five friendlies we've got then? So it's there's a Guiseley game, there's a Blackburn game, there's a Fleetwood game, and then Betis and Ajax. Is that five friendlies?
Yeah. So you would expect, I guess, two 11s to play the first four games or the majority of them.
Yeah.
And then we'll see something of a coming together for that Ajax game.
Yeah, it should be really good fun. And it's going to be fascinating seeing what the starting 11 looks like, because we just don't really know where everyone's at in the squad right now after the pre-season, whether or not Bielsa thinks that certain players have pipped other players to the post in terms of the first starting 11. So I'm quite excited to see who is going to be the sort of starting 11 for the season.
And the other little bit of news is that Leeds look like we're pretty close to the signing of Lewis Bate from Chelsea for what looks like about £1.5 million. John and Josh will be recording an author's list about Lewis Bate.
Yeah, that's recorded today. So I'll put it out probably on Thursday at some point, just so that this episode has a chance to hit first. But yeah, we had a lovely long chat about a few targets actually this week. We talked about the central midfield role, really. So we looked at Farid Boulaye, who's a player who's been linked from Metz in France. We talked about Oke Yakuzlu, who was on loan last season at West Brom, who some of you might know, Lewis Bate from the Chelsea setup, and also the new player came up, I guess he was linked last night, called Jens Kajusta, who is a Swedish youngster who's playing in Denmark at Midtjylland, and Josh is very excited about him. I haven't had the chance to watch him yet, so if any of that is interesting to you, head over to our Patreon Patreon and have a check of that. That will be out tomorrow, I think.
Okay, let's get into it then. As I was saying earlier, this is going to be a Leeds-specific chat, but we'll try and address some general points as well. It would be a bit difficult, I think, to cover the entire of football tactics in the space of an hour or so. But we've got an interesting question from Sebastian Uhlenberg to start with. And he says, where exactly do you guys separate tactics and strategy? Also, do you discern which actions and movements within a game are down to tactics and strategy, and which are just a product of multiple individual decisions by the players? We'll come to you on that, John.
Yeah, an interesting question. I guess it's sort of highlighting the gap there is between the theoretical and the actual play on the field. So obviously, whenever you're talking about tactics, there is always going to be that gap between, you know, the theories and ideas that we're talking about, the theories and ideas that coaches are talking about when they're talking to the players, and what actually unfolds on the pitch. And I suppose Sebastian's question is, you know, how much are these games scripted? How much wiggle room is there when a coach is planning a game? How much will they will they be able to say and expect the players to replicate that on the field? So an interesting question. It was funny, last night Josh and I actually spoke to Graham Smith, who is everyone knows who Graham Smith is, so I'm not going to explain who Graham Smith is, but he was talking about one of the weird phenomena from last season was that he were able to hear Marcelo Bielsa giving tactical instructions in empty stadiums because there was no fans, and he was saying that he was amazed at how simple the instructions that are given are. So he said it was mainly just Tyler move that he would hear, but you would hear a lot of stuff about, you know, watch the ball, move to the ball, really basic instructions. And so I guess the big question for a lot of people who are maybe a little bit more tactics skeptical would be an outlet like us, who talk a lot about the tactics, maybe probably overplay them in terms of what the coaches and the players are thinking of. Is there an expectation that players are actually thinking about these things as they go, or is it just a case that good players will sort of just have a rough idea of what to do? Will they not even really think about it, but they'll have training sessions which mean that they sort of naturally make movements rather than even thinking about them? So I think it's a fair question. So I think what we're trying to do is just post hoc, after the fact, look at what's going on and say, are there any ideas here that we can pick out? Are there any repeatable actions that could suggest that a coach is saying this is the way that you want to play? So, yeah, I guess this is a bit of a caveat to say this is just us doing guesswork after the fact, watching the tape. But there's a big gap between what we're doing and what it is that the coaches are doing as well in the training sessions.
And it feels like Leeds fans are almost uniquely positioned to see the effects that tactics can or cannot have on a squad, because we've had so many managers over the last 10 years, for a start, who have varying approaches. And we've all obviously had a master tactician in Marcelo Bielsa come in and completely change how a lot of these players play. So, Tom, do you think having Marcelo Bielsa in charge and contrasting with what went before, has that increased your understanding or of tactics?
Yeah, absolutely. Like before Bielsa, I would say that I didn't really have any understanding of tactics, and I just, mainly because what came before him was just so disinteresting. And like what John said about there being like repeatable actions, and that's probably what you would define as a tactic. Like, how often did any manager that came before Bielsa in the last 10 years have a repeatable action that we could actually say, oh, that's something that we're trying to do, apart from maybe Monk saying, give it, hit it into the channels and Chris Wood will chase it. Like, there really wasn't that much. So, yeah, I would say Bielsa has definitely sort of improved my knowledge, but I've also been more interested in the tactics that we're seeing now. So that's probably a factor in it as well.
I think you might be being a little bit unfair on Simon Grayson's kickoff routine. You lump it back and then the striker pulls out to the left wing and the ball goes straight out for a throw-in. If that's not a repeatable action, I'm not sure what is. But okay, so we're going to split this podcast in general into three parts. We'll start off talking about structure, then we'll move on to talking about movement, and then at the end we'll have a little bit of a glossary where we can talk about some various terms that people may have heard and what they mean and how they can be applied to tactics. So we'll start with structure, and there's a very interesting question here from Dan Holdsworth. So he says, I know formations are passé in these parts, but Bielsa's leads are often written up as a 4-1-4-1, whereas Pep City are described as a 4-3-3 when they play a centre forward, yet the team shape isn't massively different. Do you think there is a functional difference between the formations? And my immediate thought on this is that it's almost all to do with the way that people have written it down, and the way that people are used to calling it. Do you have any thoughts on that, Tom?
I don't know if it's just unique to Bielsa, but me, John and Josh had a chat about this actually, like that on Patreon at some point, that Bielsa is like, it's a defensive formation, whereas I don't know if that's the case for other managers, but I think for me, like the 4-1-4-1 kind of makes me think that the two wingers are more out-and-out wingers, whereas the 4-3-3 makes me think that the two wingers are more sort of, you would put, if you were on Football Manager, you'd call it an inside forward. So that's the difference for me if I was going to describe it. But I just don't. I think like a 4-1-4-1, a 4-3-3, and even like a 4-2-3-1 are all in effect three midfielders, three further forward players, aren't they? So it's weird how people distinguish between the two of them when we're written down as a 4-1-4-1, but we were playing probably playing a 4-2-3-1 to a large extent last season.
So you think it's almost an expression of width?
I would say that in this case, yeah. I don't know if that's the case for every formation.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we had another question that I haven't put in here, but it was talking about why it is that when we talk about formations, we're mainly talking about defensive structure. So when we say 4-1-4-1, that's the way that Leeds we'll be seeing it when the opposition have the ball and they're a little bit deeper in their own half, with your two fullbacks dropped in alongside the centre backs and then your two wingers tucked in alongside the central midfielders. And I suspect the reason why we call the Leeds a 4-1-4-1 is because of that, because there is the expectation that the wide players do defensive work. But yeah, I think it's important to accept as Dan says, that formations are, I suppose, a little bit passé, in the sense that a formation really is just, it is very much just an attempt to put a figure on a very fluid system. And as we know with Marcelo Bielsa, that system will change as soon as we become attacking. The two centre-backs, the two full-backs, will push up. We all at times see the defensive midfielder drop in behind, drop in between the two centre-backs, or maybe to one side or other of the two centre-backs, making a three. You may see formations where there is an asymmetry. So, for example, Spurs this season under Nuno are talking about playing quite an asymmetrical back four, where one of their fullbacks will push much further forward than the other, and they'll attack down one side. And that means you can have maybe a more defensive fullback on one side and a more attacking fullback on the other. So there is that asymmetry there. And as we'll talk about in the movement section, a big edge that Marcelo Bielsa gets from Leeds is this ability to plunder space through player movements as well. So formation, I think, is more just a shorthand to sort of tell you roughly where the players are. But in this instance, I do just think it's just a reflection of the fact that if you're a wide player in a Bielsa system, you're expected to do a lot more defensive work than you are if you're in a front three in a Pep team.
Yeah, that's a good point. So when you talk about Leeds' tactics, one of the first things that comes up is the man-marking system, and that's because hardly anyone else uses it in world football. So why, John, do you think Bielsa does choose to use a man-marking system, and what difference does it make, the fact that he does choose to use one?
Yeah, I go backwards and forwards on this, because the man-marking system, I think, is all there because the way that Marcelo Bielsa wants to press is influenced by it. And I guess I end up always in this sort of chicken and egg scenario where I'm kind of thinking, do we have a man marking system because it makes it easier to press, or do we press because Marcelo Bielsa wants to use a man marking system in that sense as well? So I think that the two things are really, really closely aligned in that sense. That if you're man marking, if players have a marking responsibility, when it comes to pressing structures, there's no confusion about who should be pressing who, because you're largely pressing the same player every time. And I think the reason why Bielsa likes the man marking system is because of that, because it does just takes a level of conceptuality out of it. So players don't need to be thinking, right, who should I be marking now? What should my pressing action be? They can simply be like, what should my pressing action be? I know where my player is. Now, as we'll go on to talk about in a minute, there's a little bit of fluidity in the man marking system, so it's not quite so simple as that. But I think Bielsa likes the man marking system because there's just a level of conceptual simplicity to it, which just allows you to have that in the back of your mind. You don't need to talk through who's marking who in every game beyond the "this is your responsibility" conversation, and that's it.
Do you think that because the fact that Marcelo Bielsa has been managing a long time, and he's started formulating his tactical identity back, I guess, in the, I'm not sure if it was the early 90s or the late 80s when he was working at Newell's Old Boys with the youth team. But back then, man marking was much more common, but pressing was much less common. So do you think that this combination of man marking and pressing came about partially because Bielsa was such an early adopter of pressing when man marking was considered a much more valid mainstream idea in football?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm not 100% on the genealogy of it. I think I'm right in saying that the current approach that Bielsa has emerges when he's back in Argentina after he's been to Mexico for a little while. I don't think they necessarily played like a high man marking system in his stint at Newell's. I obviously haven't watched any of those games or really read any of the tactics of that time, but I'm pretty sure that he comes back to Argentina for a stint just before he then comes across to Europe. I think he goes to one of the Spanish sides.
Espanyol,
exactly. And he doesn't really manage there because he gets picked up by the Argentinian national team. But I think before that, he is at an Argentine side. Vélez Sarsfield, I think it is. Yeah, Vélez. And I think that's where the real classic Bielsa tactics really emerge. I think it's probably not a temporal thing. It's probably more of a continental thing. I think probably, as you said, in Argentina, there is a tendency for football to be more vigorous, to be more high tempo, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what happens then is he probably plays this fairly intense pressing football early on. And I think man marking is brought in as a way of maybe formalizing that structure a little bit more. But I'm just vamping here. I don't know what the actual genealogy looks like.
Okay, so apart from man marking, one of the other unusual things that Marcelo Bielsa does is that he will always change his own team's formation in some relation to the opponent's formation, often many, many times per game. I can't think of any other manager that will do this literally every other time, every single time the opponent changes formation. And we've described this in the past as a sort of plus one, minus one concept. Tom, could you explain to us what that is?
Yeah, so basically the plus one, minus one concept is that Bielsa will always want his, when leads to the leads defence, so I'll use a back four as an example, to have an extra man over the opposition. So if we're playing a back four, the opposition will be playing in a front three, and then up front, we will say we're playing two wingers and Bamford, so three up front, they will be playing, they're playing a back four because we will have one less man than them. And this is basically just so that we have the extra man when we're defending, so that three of the players can go man for man, and then the extra defender is sort of covering the space, so then it's almost like cleaning up if any players loses their man. And we have the minus one up front because I just think Bielsa's happier to sort of have a man free in that area of the pitch, because they're not as likely to, well, they're not going to cause you as much damage really, unless they go full John Stones getting a million progressive yards against us. But yeah, it's just because he's happier to have an extra man there, and he's also, maybe this is something we'll come on to later, but it's then you can see it in the way that the forward presses, is that they will press the free centre-back or the free defender to try and sort of block the pass to the other man. But that's an area of the pitch where you're more happy to do that rather than in the midfield or when they're the opposition are attacking.
And people talk, don't they, about Bielsa's famous 3-3-1-3, as though that's some formation that he feels is a platonic ideal of football. But really, that only developed as a counteraction to the homogeny of 4-4-2 in football at the time when he was mostly playing it. I think if you look back through Bielsa's most recent few clubs, he's actually very rarely playing the 3-3-1-3, because most teams are playing with one striker now, aren't they?
Yeah, so I guess that if you're going to be matching up player for player and you're going to have an extra defender at the back and you have to take that extra player from the front, you are so dependent, as you've said, on what the opposition are playing. So Marcelo Bielsa doesn't sit down and say, right, which formation are we going to play against this team? Because I want to play in a certain way. He will always think, right, what's the most likely formation that this team will be playing in? And then you just plug in the numbers and out at the other end pops the formula. So yeah, he'll match up in the midfield. So the midfield, if it's four midfielders across, so two central midfielders and two wide players, you'll just match for Leeds as well. So you have two midfielders marking the two midfielders and then the two wide players marking the two wide players. And then obviously the plus and minus concept at the back and front. So yeah, when you have a 4-4-2, you have a back three against two strikers, and then you have a front three against a back four at the other end. So you're sort of forced into having a 3-3-1-3-ish formation, because so many teams are playing 4-4-2. Teams don't really play 4-4-2 as much now, although we are seeing a bit of a resurgence of it. And so that means that Leeds is more likely to play in either the 4-1-4-1 or 4-2-3-1, some iteration of that. We occasionally see a 3-5-2 against a 3-5-2, but all of these things just come down to the fact that there's going to be a logical structure. Players are going to match up, and you're going to have that plus one at the back and the minus one at the front to allow you to be able to do the man marking system.
And other than the things that it's necessarily designed to do, which is as we said, to counteract the opponent's structure, Tom, what do we think the main differences are between when we play with a back three and when we play with a back four?
We struggle more, I think, building up in a 3-3-1-3. I think that's something that we've said a lot on this podcast, and it's never something that I've managed to sort of, or we've never managed to sort of pinpoint why that is the case. I think it's the only explanation I can ever sort of give for it is that we lose an eight, I think, in that formation. So we kind of lose one of those players sort of dropping in, or that extra option for a pass, which means that I just think we struggle with building up and passing is more, because I think apart from that, I don't think there are many differences between the way we attack in that formation compared to when we play a back four.
Yeah, I was going to say that whenever we play in, even in that 4-1-4-1, we can end up almost forming a 3-3-1-3 formation in our build-up play as well, with the fullbacks pushing forward and everyone else sort of falling into that schema. So if one of the eights pushes forward, is almost like a 10, and the wingers push up alongside Bamford, then you've got your front three, you've got a 10, and then your DM sort of pushes up alongside the other eight, and I guess you end up sort of roughly with your 3-3-1-3 formation there again, depending on how it goes. So I think that Bielsa likes the fact that, because so much of what we're going to talk about in the movement section is about set routines and movements and interchanges and exchanges that are regular, there's something about the man-marking system as well which adds to it from an attacking point of view, that it allows you to know that your players are roughly going to be in the same sorts of positions, starting positions, if they're matching up to the opponent, that they can then just fall into these routine attacking plays. So I've written about this on our Medium somewhere, but just sort of looking at some of the reasons why you might use a man-marking system, and I do think that is one of them. The other thing you can get there as well is that if everyone's man-marking in an out-of-possession phase, when you win the ball back, because you're close to your player, you can get a run on your player quite easily, so you can run into the space behind them. And usually you get the benefit from that as well. So I do think everything sort of ties up. You have the man-marking system because Bielsa wants to play a sort of high-pressing game, and he thinks this helps him to do that. But he also wants to play a high-pressing game because he wants to control the ball quickly. He wants to have possession of the ball, wants to get it back as quickly as possible. And in order to be able to get the ball back and then involve himself in or involve the team in these transitional build-up plays as well. So there's a sort of there is a sort of osmosis between these two. That's probably not the right word, but sort of like an organic interchange between these two things. So the man marking helps you in your attacking play, and your attacking play is benefited by your man marking high pressure because it allows you to try and control the ball. It allows you to be attacking, but then win the ball back without necessarily leaving yourself open for counter attacks and stuff. So yeah, it's quite beautiful how the whole thing sort of melds together.
And this isn't anything that I've got on the running order, but I just realised that we've not actually explained to the listeners. I think most of them will be aware, but you know, what is a 6? What is an 8? What is a 10? I think everyone knows what a 9 is, but and I think most people probably know what a 10 is. But if you can just briefly explain what a 6 and an 8 would be.
There's people who will argue that the numbering system is wrong. They will say the English system is to say that a defensive midfielder is a number 4. I think that's maybe the English way of doing it. And then 6 is maybe an Argentinian way of doing it, which is what Bielsa will do. But yeah, a 6 is just a defensive midfielder, and 8 is more of a, you know, a sort of central midfielder who's probably a bit more of a ball carrier, and then a 10, a slightly more attacking midfielder. But I guess at this point it is interesting to talk about those positions, because obviously Leeds do play with a single pivot, so you can talk about the 6 or 4 no problem. But when you're talking about an 8, Leeds have 2 8s, and people will talk about maybe a slightly more attacking 8 and a more, I guess, ball carrier 8. But I do think that that's perhaps overstated a little bit. I don't think that Bielsa necessarily thinks that I need to have an attacking player and a defensive player. It's happened that way in this season's Premier League, and I suppose we've roughly had a more attacking midfielder and defensive midfielder in those 8 spots. But I guess thinking back to having Adam Forshaw and Matthias Klick in those two positions, I wouldn't necessarily describe Klick as a 10.
It's not like you to think back to that period, John.
I do occasionally go back and cast my mind back to those, whatever it was, 7 games at the beginning of the promotion season. But I do think that we can overstate it. You can force players into that system too much and say, well, we need to have this kind of player on one side and this kind of player on the other. I think there's an extent to which, as we've seen this season, you know, Bielsa can pretty much play with a 2-man pivot at times. It was not really a pivot, but a 2-man defensive system when he wants to with Dallas. Dallas is probably more of a 6 than he is an 8 in those systems. Maybe a little bit more of a box to box player, so you probably would call him the 8. But yeah, I think when you have a mixture of players who play in different ways, the formation can sort of accommodate for that. And I think that Bielsa isn't too worried about necessarily having a sort of ideal in his head about who should play in those 2 8 positions. So
we've seen it quite a lot over what 3 seasons now. Like it was Size and Klick for a long period until Size left, and I think it was mainly Roberts and Klick. So it's like they're, which you would all think they're more attack minded players, and then we had probably the ideal version where we was Forshaw. I don't know if that's Bielsa's ideal or our ideal. And then it was Pablo for a long stretch. So there isn't, whilst we all do talk about the more attacking 8 and the more defensive 8, it was shown over three years of Bielsa that it's easily changeable and not something that's really set in stone.
And going back to the man-marking system, I've kind of messed the order of this up a little bit, but how does it change when it comes to set pieces? Are we still strictly man-marking, or are we a little bit more nuanced than that?
Yeah, I think we have 2 zonal players in a corner routine usually. Obviously, it changes up a little bit on free kicks, depending on where the free kick's being taken by the opposition. But we'll have Bamford on the front post as the first player to head the ball away. And we usually have either Rafinha or Jack Harrison on the front post, just hugging the post. And the idea, I think, with those two being 3 is that if you are in a situation where you can then counter-attack, you don't want them to necessarily worry about their player. So you're covering the front post, but then in the event of a counter-attack, they can just bomb forwards and put pressure on the opposition as well. Same with Bamford for that matter too. But Bamford, probably one of our better defensive set-piece players in many respects.
Do we think that Bamford is given that role because he's good in the air and because he can get he can get those balls away, or do we think it's because in regular play he doesn't have a man marking duty assigned, so it's simpler that way to leave him at set pieces not having one?
Yeah, it's possible. I suspect that he probably would be our best defensive header of the ball, weirdly. So I don't know whether or not they've ever talked about him potentially being in the middle and taking on the strongest header for the opposition. But I suspect it's probably just more to do with the fact that they just want him to be flexible to get out. And I guess if he runs towards the ball and heads the ball out, he can then sort of just follow his run on and create space. Whereas I think, obviously, if you don't win the second ball after a set piece comes in, your defensive players, man on man, are going to have to stay in the middle and keep close to their players. Whereas I think they just want Bamford then to, once he's done his job of clearing the ball, to just get into an attacking position where he can then hold the ball up. So I suspect it's probably more to do with that.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, so let's move on to talk about pressing, because pressing is something that everyone talks about when it comes to Leeds United. We regularly are putting up the highest running numbers and that kind of thing, but what we're going to talk about now is the high press and the counter press, which is also known as gegenpressing from the Germans who invented it. As far as I can tell, this counter-pressing idea, and I think it was Jurgen Klopp had the famous quote that gegenpressing is the best playmaker or something like that. John, can you tell us a little bit about counter-pressing in general? I mean, I know you watch a lot of German football, so you should be fairly familiar with the origins of this and how it developed.
Yes, I think it's important at this point to distinguish between high-pressing and counter-pressing, because those two things are very different. So a high-press is simply any pressure system which is going to try and engage with the opposition high up the pitch. So you'll probably be pressing, you'll probably be pressing their centre backs in the build-up play, or if the opposition are sort of hemmed in, you'll have players just stopping the opposition from settling on the ball and then being able to clear the ball down the field and reduce some of the pressure. So that's what a high press is. And it's, I think, also important to say that, you know, we're going to talk about high press, we're going to talk about a mid block, and we're going to talk about a low block. And these are all different pressure systems, but there is always going to be commensurability between them. That you will never just entirely high press. There'll be situations where you'll have a mid press, you'll have a low block in certain situations as well. Every team will do different things, but I guess when we're talking about a team like Leeds being high press, what we're saying is that their instinct is going to be to try and engage as quickly as possible with the ball, and that will mean if the opposition are trying to build up from the back, that means that they will push higher up the pitch and engage there. Counter-pressing is slightly different, because, as it suggests, what you're doing with the pressure there is not just to win the ball back, but to win the ball back in a certain phase of the game whereby you can then counter-attack from it. So, gegenpressing is just the German phrase for counter-pressing, pressing against a team. And I guess what the idea is here is that if you can press the ball back quickly in that high area, win it back, the opposition will be in a possession phase. So they will usually, in possession, what you're trying to do is have as much space between your players so that you can manipulate the space easier. It's harder for the opposition to mark you. So if you can win the ball back in that phase, there's a lot of space for you to exploit. So gegenpressing teams are teams that will try and win back the ball really quickly after a turnover and make the most of a or even a build-up, I should say, not really a turnover, but that the idea there is that you win the ball back quickly and then exploit the spaces within the defensive team by having like really quick attacks. Gegenpressing is that something that I would necessarily describe Leeds as doing a lot of the time? Probably not, because I don't think that we necessarily have an intense high press in terms of numbers. We'll not often have more than two or three players pressing the ball because of the man marking system. But I do think we've seen it at times in the last season. So I remember Josh Hobbs put up a video last season just showing Calvin Phillips winning the ball back for the high press, and as a result of that, Leeds being able to set off on a quick attack. And there's a couple of examples actually of Pascal Strauch. I think he wins the ball back, and the ball ends up going to Jack Harrison, who sets up Rodrigo for that lovely chip. Was it against Burnley? That to me would be an example of a counter press. But I think when you talk about teams who counter press, what you're thinking of is teams like RB Leipzig, whose whole model is almost you. When you're building up from the back, you launch the ball into your forward to hold for them to hold it up. If they don't win the second ball, you then jump on the second ball with a really aggressive midfield press, and then the idea then is to just win the ball back in that situation and sort of batter your way through. Whereas I don't think Leeds are quite so much about that. I think for them, their high press is a lot more about winning the ball back once it's been turned over, so that you can't get counter-attacked on yourself. And this is something that City do. So City have a high press because they like to control possession in the opposition half. They have a really high back line, and if they lose the ball in an attacking situation, it's very easy for opponents to pick the ball up and then find dangerous balls in behind, and their defence can get turned over. So for them, the high press is very much about stopping the opposition from being able to do that. So it's almost like a defensive high press rather than an attacking high press, which is what you get from gegenpressing.
And I think an example of gegenpressing that Leeds fans will all remember would be when we played Barnsley in the Championship towards the end of last season, and they seem to have very consciously chosen a lot of coaches from Germany who are interested in this approach and know how to implement it. And I remember reading some stat that Barnsley had 7% lower pass completion than any other team in Europe's top five leagues or top six leagues or whatever it was. And the idea is just essentially lump the ball up to a big man and then press the hell out of it when, you know, if the flick on doesn't come. So it's interesting when you think about long ball being a sort of a retrograde way to play football, to see people playing it in interesting new ways that are actually quite sophisticated.
I think Arsenal is another good example of that. The Arsenal game where they beat us 4-2, that was another great example of sort of counter-pressing, in that they just pressed really high and stopped us from being able to build up. And then because they have the attacking players who can then punish you in those situations in our build-up phase, we really struggled against them. So yeah, you'll remember Melier giving away, gave away a penalty.
When it comes to counter-pressing, there's a really interesting question here, I thought, from Adam Michael Finney. He asks, watching Southgate's England team, there were almost no 2v1 counter-presses to win the ball back. Leeds, although playing man-to-man, create many 2v1s while counter-pressing. I remember Mourinho talking about how Klopp created 3v1s all over Klopp's Dortmund as they beat Real Madrid in the Champions League. So how does Bielsa create pressing overloads in man-to-man marking?
Well, the Southgate one, it probably involves a team having to actually commit men forward to counter press with a 2v1. So that would probably answer that question. but I think a big part of the Bielsa one is that this is something I kind of touched on earlier, that the way that sort of Leeds press an opponent is like they will block the passing lane to the player they are marking. So then press it. So like they are leaving their man, but they still, it's a hard option for the player to pass the ball. So that's why it gives the impression of 2v1s all over the pitch. And it's a function of the man marking system, that they then when they press and will leave their markers, they are able to overload the players when they're counter pressing in this way.
And as John was saying, that's why it looks like 2v1s rather than 3v1s or 4v1s like you might see with Liverpool, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think it's just the way that the structure breaks down is that you'll always have a couple of players around the ball, because there's always going to be an easy-ish option for the pass out. So what happens is, as Tom says, you'll see a player closing the passing lane and then pressing. But Leeds will never commit more than two or three players, because they still have to think about where their players are. And so if too many players commit to the immediate press, then you'll end up with system overloads elsewhere, and that's going to be a problem in the long run.
Okay, so in terms of structure, does anyone have anything else they'd like to add before we move on?
No, we've got on the running order just a mid block and low block, which I think are probably worth talking about just even in passing. But Josh and I spoke to Eric Laurie, a coach on our Patreon podcast recently, and he was talking about how we probably will see teams moving to more of a mid-block system, and that's really, really interesting. If you wanted to understand a little bit more about high, mid and low blocks, do head over to our Patreon and check that out. But the general theory is that when you're playing a high pressing system, obviously you're not controlling a huge space from behind your high press, so you have the halfway line, and then your own defensive half is usually not very well defended, and there'll be plenty of examples you can think of where Leeds have conceded goals on the break because of that. Equally, a low block has the other problem, right? So you're controlling your own defensive third, but you're not controlling the midfield third or the opponent's defensive third. And the mid block sit in the middle, but you have a little bit of a level of control over the forward third, and then you have a little bit of control over the backward third as well. And Eric Laurie's argument was that we're going to see more mid block systems, where so teams working out how to sit in a more passive formation, but then engaging as and when they want to push forward in certain situations or drop back in certain situations. So a mid block is simply that, where you are trying to just control space, keep an eye in the front third and be able to cover the back third in case teams are going to try and hit the space in behind you. And so I think, it's interesting following that sort of tactical development. And low blocks, I think, are worth talking about, because a lot of people think that Leeds... Well, there's a lot of talk about Leeds struggling against low blocks. But I think a lot of people don't really necessarily understand when a low block is a low block. But there's a lot of times in the Championship in particular where Leeds were sitting against low blocks. So the opposition would just sit deep, wouldn't allow any spaces in there. Defensive structure and would invite Leeds to break them down, and then obviously would try and attack into that space behind the Leeds Leeds line of pressure and try and get counter attacking goals as well. So hopefully that just gives you a bit of a sense of what a mid and low block is.
And is there anything that you could look for, any sort of telltale signs on the pitch as to which one of these high, mid or low blocks a team might be playing, like the position of the striker in defence, or for example, or something like that?
I think the best thing to do is to keep a mental note of where pressures are taking place. But by pressure, we just mean any player moving towards a player on the ball with the task of either slowing them down, forcing them wide, or winning the ball back. And I think you can learn a huge amount by watching an opponent's build-up and seeing where it is that the first line of pressure comes. So if you're watching Leeds and seeing them build up, just have a look and see, are the centre-backs able to just entirely move the ball around backwards and forwards between the back line without any pressure really coming in? You're probably not playing against a high press. If you then move it forward towards the halfway line, and then the first line of pressure is coming there, that's probably a mid block. And a low block, basically they're just inviting you to transition the ball all the way down the field before that pressure comes in. So they're basically saying, we're not going to worry about you transitioning from a defensive position to an attacking position. What we're going to do is we're going to try and make it as hard as possible for you to score in that attacking in our final third. So it's all about where the engagement of the pressure is taking place rather than where the team is sitting, because you can have a team that sits quite high but they won't engage until in a certain situation. And so a great example of that is maybe Brighton. So Brighton did really do really well against us is they forces into wide areas. So they are sort of doing a semi-high press because they are going to try and force you into your fullbacks, but then they'll allow the ball to just transition down the side of the field, and then suddenly they'll spring this pressing trap where the wing back and then the outside centre back and then the outside forward will all converge on a space, and the central midfielder will come across as well, and you end up with them boxing in players in quite advanced areas. But that the real moments of pressure aren't really coming until around the sort of halfway line, the final third. But they are doing pressing higher up the field because they are dictating where they want the ball to go.
And for the listeners, John is wearing a blue t-shirt with a seagull on it, so it's no surprise that he would be extolling the virtues of Brighton's pressing system. Anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about movement. So the first thing that I've got in this running order about movement is a term that I've always had a bit of a problem with. It's positional play. And the reason I've always had a bit of a problem with it is just because I would have thought that all football would be positional play. So, John, can you tell us what you mean, what is meant when learned football people talk about positional play?
So positional play is something which is developed from out of, I think, again, South American football, certainly Spanish-speaking football. You may have seen it called juego de posición or something like that. I won't try and say that properly. But there's been a lot of arguments on Twitter recently, actually, about the usefulness of a phrase like positional play, because, it's really, really hard to define what positional play is, because, as Tom says, you know, all football teams are attempting to manipulate positions through movement and build up. And even if you're hitting the ball long, right, there's still a positional element to that. The classic definition of positional play is that you're using your players and using movements of the players to create superiorities, which sounds awful, I suppose. But what they mean by a superiority is just a situation where you've got more players in a zone of the pitch than the opposition. So you're talking like a 2-on-1 or a 3-on-2, et cetera, or any combination of those numbers. But the idea then is that you're manipulating the way that the team moves so that they're able to get the ball and their players into these overloads. And the idea then is if you can do that, then you can more easily create opportunities to attack. And I guess as Leeds fans, we sort of know this. We know that the Leeds system does certain things that makes our players better, perhaps, or our teams better than the sum of their parts. And I think a lot of this is because the whole positional play system is designed to give players space and time on the ball to be able to do things. And I think the better, obviously, elite players are able to do things under pressure. They're able to do things really quickly, and they aren't put under pressure by maybe having those things removed. But for our players, some of them need to have a little bit more time, space on the ball, and the system really allows them to do that. And for me, that's what the benefits of positional play are. So because Bielsa can teach them to move in certain ways, what they're all doing is affording each other more space and time on the ball, so that when they're attacking, they can generate these superiorities, and they have not just you're not worrying necessarily just about having superior players. Then you're worrying about having more numbers of players in small areas, so that you can overcome the fact that the opposition might have superior players by having more players around the ball in these various situations. So for me, that's what positional play is, and that's what the edge that we get from Marcelo Bielsa is in terms of the structural stuff.
Yeah, it's funny that you talk about superiority sounding like an awful concept. I can imagine Kiko Casillas sees it a very different way, although he would probably also claim to have not understood the word or never heard of it before. So when it comes to football terminology, it seems like there's a bit of a hierarchy as to the things that everyone knows. Like, everyone knows what possession is. Everyone knows what a shot is. And then there's a sort of level beyond that where you'll start to get some pushback from proper football men. And I guess this is one of the key terms that proper football men tend to get upset about. I think I remember Stan Collymore having a bit of a bee in his bonnet about this one. And this is transition. So, Tom, what do we mean when we talk about transitional states or about teams transitioning the ball and things like that?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned about the hierarchy of these words, actually, because ever since I've started doing this podcast, I've started saying transition a lot when I'm discussing football with my friends, and they think I sound like a right knob because I'm trying to sound clever. But yeah, so transition is basically, there's sort of two sort of states a team could be in. They can either be defending, so they're in their block, which is out, so, well, mid block, high block, low block, or they're sort of in their almost like an attacking formation. Like we mentioned earlier, the Leeds do tend to attack in a 3-3-1-3. And then the transition is basically the period between when, say, if a team has the ball, they're attacking, and then when they lose the ball, they are then transitioning into their block. So that's, and then similarly, when a team is defending, they, if they then regain the ball, they are then transitioning into getting into the attacking phase of the game, where they are sort of obviously nearer to the opposition's goal, and they're into sort of their attacking formation. Yeah, so the transition is just sort of the bit between the between those two states. And because there isn't like, there's to a lesser extent, there's like less of a formation in this at this time. So that's when you can see teams getting caught in transition, which is a phrase that we use a lot. And it's easy to sort of beat a man or cause teams problems when they're in these two states.
And we'll use the term transitional a lot on the podcast, right? We'll say that, oh, this was a very transitional game if we're playing Southampton or someone like that. That, as far as I can tell, basically means it's a game where there are lots of transitions, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think Tom Warville did an article on The Athletic where it was like the number of possessions a team has per game. And I think Southampton and Leeds were two of the highest teams on that. So that suggests to me like they're sort of not losing the ball, but there's a lot of turnovers. So there's therefore a lot more transitioning because those teams are going from their attacking state to their defensive state a lot more because they're having a lot more possessions of the ball.
And another term that we hear used quite a lot in relation to Leeds, but I think in relation to a lot of teams, is especially Manchester City, actually, is overload to isolate. So, Tom, can you tell us what that means?
Leeds is a great example of this. Probably not this year, but was when we were in the Championship. Is if you're wanting to, so in Leeds' case, it's you're wanting to isolate Jack Harrison 1-on-1 against his fullback, and the way Leeds did this is they would the build up would take up would be mainly on the right hand side, so you'd have Ayling one of the eights, and then Costa, and then the build up on that side, and then when the opportunity arises you switch the ball to Harrison, and because the opposition are defending more on the right hand side of the pitch, there's more space for Harrison on that side, and he can sort of attack his fullback 1-on-1. So that's overloading on the right-hand side to isolate Harrison on that left-hand side.
And one of the ways you might get the ball to Harrison would be via a crossfield ball. And John, I know you're not a huge fan of crossfield balls, so can you suggest any alternative methods?
Yeah, so I guess this is moving us more into the sort of the area of build-up in general. So anyone who watches Leeds will know that when Leeds have the ball from a goal kick, or if the goalkeeper ends up with the ball in his hands from whatever situation, what tends to happen is that Leeds will try and build up from the back, and you'll all have a good sense of what that looks like. The ball usually goes to either one of the centre backs. If the centre backs are being pressed, you might see Mellier clip the ball over to one of the full backs. But the general principle, I think, of our build up is that we try and move the ball into wide areas to start off with, and then we use our midfielders as a way of helping that build up in the wide areas. So you'll often see either Calvin Phillips or one of the eights dropping in if the fullback has the ball, to help them do a quick bounce pass down the field so that they can get into a more advanced area. And then once we get into those wide areas further down the field, you'll see again the fullback will help out the wide player, and you'll see the centre midfielder on that side making a triangle where they'll play the ball around and try and get the ball into a dangerous situation as well. So that's the general build-up principle. What we see is the ball going out wide to the fullbacks. The fullbacks then moving it into a more advanced areas using the wingers and the central midfielders. And then if the ball isn't sort of played quickly in a quick attacking transition, you'll see this sort of build up with three or four players, with Calvin Phillipson sitting in the middle of the field, able to switch the ball between one side to the other. The first moment of the build up is called the salida. Again, that's a Spanish word, so it's something that Bielsa will probably, I don't know if he talks about it with the players, but that's a Spanish word which just means exit. And that's the whole point, is how do you get out of your own half, maintain the possession of the ball, and get into a situation where you can then get the ball into dangerous areas. And so that is a very fundamental idea. And there's a lot of players that you'll see, there's a lot of managers that you'll see in South America who will use that kind of mode of build-up. The other thing that you might see is the centre-back dropping in between the the two fullbacks to just give a little bit, give them a little bit more time on the ball as well. Or you may see, and Granit Xhaka is someone who does this a lot, someone who drops inside behind in the space left behind the fullback, so the fullback can push down the field, the central midfield pivot can drop into that space, and then there's, again, you're just giving yourself more options to be able to maintain possession of the ball and get it into more advanced areas whilst maintaining control of the ball. That's something that many people will know well, but that will be that's really, really scripted, and I'm always tempted to sort of do a long study on this and just break down the top five ways that Leeds build up from the back, but I think I'd probably need some data to do that for me rather than just watching all of the build-up phases that Leeds do on video and just tracking it.
As exciting as that would be. So Leeds feel like they're quite unique in, well, not unique, but different to both how people expect them to be and to other managers that play possession football in the back, in that once we get it into the opponent's half, we generally attack quite directly, right? As opposed to someone like Manchester City, who will continue to play, not slowly as such, but they'll continue to play lots of combinations until they work a very definite gap, where it seems like Bielsa would ideally try and attack as quickly as possible once he starts to reach the final third.
Yeah, again, it depends on the situation. And part of the problem with talking about the tactics of Leeds is that we've been in two different divisions in the last 5 years. And so, you know, the glory period that we talk about, that seven-game period at the beginning of the promotion season, we were just playing ultimate control football. We were just holding the ball. We were able to just manipulate oppositions. We were able to move the ball into dangerous areas and create dangerous chances. And when you're doing that, then you are going to be able to talk about, you know, the Salida, this build up, this slow build up. You're able to talk about overloading to isolate because you're holding the ball in one area for a long time, and you're able to pull players in from the opposition and allow your wide players to get isolated on the opposite side. But what we're seeing in the Premier League is much more of what we've called this transitional thing, which is the realization that when it comes to possessing the ball, Leeds going up against Premier League sides aren't going to have a cutting edge in the same way that they did in the Championship. So we're talking a lot more about transitional football now, because again, that's where Leeds get their edge. Leeds team are so fit that you can constantly switch possession backwards and forwards, you can constantly press, you can constantly harry teams, and you can counter-attack at pace. When that's the situation that is available to you, then the best thing for you to do in those situations is to be more transitional, because if we went possession heavy against these teams, they would just grind us to the floor. But this is what we saw in the Man City game where we drew 1-1. Was that we looked really good in that game when we were playing transitional, when City allowed us to play transitional and got sort of tied up in that sort of back and forth of possession turnovers. We were in a lot of trouble. But when in the final few minutes of that game, when they just settled down, did they bring on Fernandinho, and it was able to control the game a little bit more in terms of possession, then we started looking a little bit shaky again. So I think a lot of what we're going to see this season is going to be a lot more focused around quick attacks, because that's where we're going to get our edge. We're not going to be able to break down oppositions that sit deep in the Premier League. So the best thing to try and do is to make the most of getting the ball forward quickly, so that there's no settled structure and going from there. And I guess just the final thing to say on that is that so much of your tactics, especially for Marcelo Bielsa, as we've said, rely on you being passive. When you're reacting to the structure of an opposition in order to play the formation that you're playing, you're always going to be quite passive in that sense. And the same is true in terms of like where you're going to engage in your press and how you're going to engage in terms of attacking. So if teams in the Championship very quickly realized that if they tried to possess the ball against us, they were going to lose, so they would start sitting deep and try and catch us on the counter-attack. But in the Premier League, teams aren't doing that. So teams are coming out against us and they're able to press us high, and they're able to cause us problems in mid-block, as we've seen with teams like Brighton. And so for Leeds, the best thing to do now is to just try and be as quick and transitional and as direct and counter-attacking as possible. Maybe it will get to the point where if we bring in better players over time, we will move to a more possessional system. But a lot of it just comes from the way that teams judge you. So if a team thinks that you're really good, they'll tend to just sit a bit deeper against you, and you'll have to be better at possession football. But obviously teams aren't going to do that against you if you're not good at possession football, so they'll probably try and get a win by putting you under pressure. So there's so many different things in play that this becomes quite a complicated issue.
Yeah, I think one of the things is that people consider Bielsa to be an ideologue, and he is an ideologue, but not in all the ways that people think he is, right? I certainly, when it comes to possession versus direct football, he's consistently shown through all of his seasons at Leeds that he will almost take the path of least resistance in that respect. He will take the path that the game indicates almost. You know, you see the very early games against Stoke and Derby, we didn't actually have that much possession. We were, you know, it was about 54%, 55%, something like that. And then also you see games against West Brom in our promotion season. They were mostly sort of 50-50 in terms of possession. And I think the threshold for where Bielsa is willing to go a bit more direct is lower than some people think it is, maybe. I think it is determined almost by the opposition in the same way that the formation is. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, Tom.
Again, similar to sort of the style we said earlier about the eights. When people sort of mention there's a six and an eight, there is not an ideal version of what Bielsa says he wants to do. He will just sort of do it for what he thinks is best for that opposition. Maybe even what the players he has available at that time, what plays their strengths. Like, you'd want a player like Rafinha probably in a transitional game, because it gives him a better opportunity to score than he would in a possession game.
I think he's idealistic about processes rather than like tactical realities, and I think that's where people kind of get him wrong. Like, he's always going to match up structurally, which means he's sort of idealistic about like the idea of structure but not specific structures, and the same is true about the attacking side of things as well. He has ways that he will play, but it is so determined by the opposition that they just seem like, it seems like a more process heavy, like a meta level idealism.
And I think this is a real problem for the TalkSport pundits of this world, because I think that is genuinely operating on a higher level of conceptual thinking than they are capable of, certainly on live radio. So they do tend to say, oh, he's just all out attack. He won't change the way he plays. But it's really, I don't really see Bielsa as any less flexible than Sam Allardyce, for example, who also has a very defined way of playing football and is not going to change it. Anyway, third man runs. Tom, what's a third man run?
The best way is probably to use an example. Like, if Click is in possession of the ball and Ayling makes a run down the outside, but he's made that run before Click is making the pass to Tyler Roberts, say, and then Ayling's already running down the side, so Roberts can play the pass in. So he's getting sort of starting the run and not just waiting for one player to possess the ball and then play the pass to them. Like, they've already started their run. And this is where, like, the patterns of play kind of come into it a bit more, that Leeds will use third man runs to sort of attack a team more at pace rather than just sort of the more controlling passing style of play, where one player gets the ball, passes it to the other. Like, Ayling expects the ball to come from Roberts, so he'll make the run before Roberts has even got the ball.
And this is where we see some of those videos. I remember there was a video of a goal Leeds scored and a goal Bielsa's Chile side scored that looked almost identical, and that's because the players have practiced these patterns and these third man runs on the training ground, right, John?
Yeah, for sure. I think the beauty of the third man run is that it just allows you to do that manipulation of space that we've talked about. So what you're talking about is, if a player makes a run, usually you would expect the pass to go directly to him. And the problem is that teams can defend against that. You can block off the passing lane, or you can track the runner. But what Leeds do really well is they find an intermediary player in between that. So you can play the ball one way and then it comes back to that original player making the run. So again, it's just about ways of moving around oppositions and adding just a little bit more of a layer there that maybe isn't there for most other clubs. But yeah, Bielsa will be running these drills all the time in training, and it's about getting the players habituated into these ideas. So yeah, I think it's just another area where you get an edge from Bielsa, because he's allowing you to manipulate space in ways that are creative and allow you to be creative with less talented players than you might do.
I think this is one area of Leeds' play that does remain the same no matter the opponent and no matter the formation that Leeds end up playing, right?
I think it was a sort of Bielsa quote that said that like, the third man run is probably the most underused thing in football, because it's hard to mark against, but it's so effective. So you could see why it's such a key feature of his teams.
And set pieces, the last little section in our movement section. I guess we're talking about attacking set pieces here rather than defensive set pieces. So not something Leeds are particularly known for. How does Marcelo Bielsa generally go about organising attacking set pieces?
My answer is I don't really have an answer. I've never really got the impression that Bielsa has something. It's like set pieces is almost something that he's not as bothered about. I don't know if I'm really being a bit harsh here, but for me it just seems to be, this is probably the most simplistic part of Bielsa's football, that it's more just there isn't really much nuance to it. Like they'll just sort of, I don't want to say, it sounds like I'm really underplaying, just putting the ball in, but I think it's not something that there are like patterns of play or two. It is much more simplistic.
Do you think maybe that's partly because in football in general, set pieces have become so much more sophisticated and you have set piece coaches at certain clubs and nearly every club is doing, you know, some kind of routine rather than just lumping the ball in. So Leeds just seem the same as anyone else, as opposed to in open play where you can see very unique things about Leeds.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm thinking back to the second season, Bielsa's second season of the Championship, that we went on a massively long run without scoring from a set piece. And then I think Click scored that one against Middlesbrough, which you could argue wasn't a set piece because he just kind of had a shot from like a second ball from a corner. And Bielsa just said, oh, this, I just let the players do it. So I just get the impression that he just doesn't care. He just sees it as a waste of time.
Didn't Graham Smith claim credit for that one? I seem to remember Graham asked him a question before one of the games, why don't you take short corners more often? And then we scored from a short corner the next game or something. But let's move on. Part 3, glossary, it says here in big, bold, capital letters. So I'm going to do this as more of a quick-fire thing. I'll name a term and I'll give you one of your names and you can tell me what it means. The first one, I think this is definitely another thing that proper football men absolutely despise. Half spaces. John, what are the half spaces?
Yeah, half spaces is a funny one. I don't really use the phrase much myself, but it's a space that I think it was developed by Pep Guardiola. Made it famous because if you look at famous pictures of the training grounds that he works on, they divide the ground up in a certain way, and the half spaces are just basically channels that aren't quite on the as wide as the touchline, but they're also outside the center of the field as well. And there's a, for some reason, that it's, they're considered to be very creative spaces, so you get a lot of creative players who will drift into these half spaces, pick up the ball and are able to create things from it. I know that David Sumpter has done some statistical analysis on it, and they reckon that the reason why half spaces are so good is because you get the best view of everything that's going on from these spaces. So I do think there is value in talking about them, but when people say half spaces, what they usually mean is that this is player is an attacking player and they found space in a slightly wide area rather than in the middle of the field.
So going back to the thing you said about Guardiola and the pictures he used, like, is it like there's five vertical zones? And like the half, yeah. There's like the centre, the wing, and then the half space is this sort of magical area between the two that there isn't really a start or end, but that's what this kind of talked about.
Yeah. So positional play, something I didn't talk about with positional play is that if you're playing against a back four, then the best spaces for you to attack are the spaces between the four centre backs. So that's the three, the middle, and then the two half spaces that you're talking about, and then outside the full backs, which is the wing area. So yeah, I think technically that's where the lines are. If you're playing against a back four, those channels will technically be open as well. So the idea is that you should be able to find through balls through there in behind the back line as well.
And turnover. This is something when we're talking about transitional games, we'll often hear the term turnover. Tom, what does that mean?
Yeah, this kind of, we kind of touched a little bit on this, I think, in the sort of counter press, gegenpressing section. But it's like when I'll say a team is attacking. And then they lose the ball, or the opposition win the ball back. That would be a turnover, and then that would be when you're changing to both teams are in their transitional phase. So the team that's attacking is then moving back to their defensive block, and the attacking team is in transition after the turnover, moving to their sort of attacking phase of the game.
And to further boil the piss of the proper football men of this world, we're going to talk about pivot. Tom, what is a pivot?
A pivot. This again is sort of covered in the Salida or the build up section, but that's like in Leeds' formation, that would be sort of Calvin Phillips. Like when they're building up, the play will pivot around Phillips because he'll be used to either sort of the one centre back will give the ball to Phillips and he'll give it back to the other centre back. So the ball sort of the movement pivots around him, or the full back will give the ball to Phillips and then he'll pass it back to centre back. So like that, it's just the pivot. He will be like the pivot player between the two passes between the right back and the centre backs.
I suppose what I'm interested in here is there ever a situation where the pivot of a team is not the deepest line midfielder, John?
Yeah, so for me, pivot is always going to be like a build-up thing, and the question is whether or not you have a single or a double pivot. I don't think you would ever talk about a pivot further up the field, because I think this is always like a low build-up thing. So a team like Manchester United will usually have a 4-2-3-1, and we would call that a double pivot because those two players are, I guess, defensive midfielders, and they'll help out in the build-up phase. And you'll have one covering one side and one covering the other. But I guess for Leeds as well, we do have like a double pivot system as well, because you'll often see one of the eights dropping in on the opposite side to Phillips. So Phillips will move one way, create space that one of the eights will then drop into too. So I guess like with anything, there's a level of slippage with all of these words. But for me, like a pivot player is the pivot aspect is that, as Tom said, they're facilitating build up between different players. So they're just players whose responsibility is to make sure that there's always an easy option on so that you can control the ball in possession.
And intuitively to me, it feels like occasionally, although you would never talk about them as a pivot, that sometimes that could also be the middle centre back in a three. Sometimes we played that way sometimes with Ben White when he was playing in the middle of a three. He would be one of the main facilitators of the ball, or am I barking up the wrong tree there?
No, you can definitely get that sort of thing happening. So something that SC Freiburg do, the team that I support in Germany, they play with a back three, but their centre back in possession pushes forward as the lowest midfielder. And again, that's just a way of allowing you to have that pivot play in the build-up phase so that you can maintain possession. So yeah, there's nothing stopping you from doing. I mean, you can talk about inverted fullbacks as well. That's exactly what they're doing as well. So when João Cancelo, the Manchester City player, inverts in the build-up phase, what he's doing is just, rather than pushing forward in a wide area, he's just helping out in the midfield so that you've got another player who can maintain possession. So technically an inverted fullback is just another pivot player really in that sense.
And it's only a matter of time before Gary Lineker demands that they play in midfield. Finally, to end the glossary and to end this end the most of the tactical discussion, we're going to talk about game state. And we all know that game state is the most important thing in football. And it's the only thing worth talking about. So, Tom, can you tell us what the game state is?
Yeah, so basically it's, if a team, well, at 0-0, that like that, it's both teams will sort of be, it's more even. But like when a team goes 1-0 up, traditionally a team will then sort of might defend that lead, so they'll go back into like a lower block rather than if they were say like in a mid block or a higher block, so they'll be defending more, and another team, the team that's losing, will be attacking more. So this is quite common when you see teams sort of rack up like 3xg after losing, because the other team is allowing them to be attack more because they have the lead. So it's like the state of the game, to make it sound a bit more exciting than it is, means that they've allowed them to attack more because they're already leading. It's in NFL, they sort of call it garbage time. So like if a team is leading so much that a team can get two touchdowns, then they just like ignore it from the stats because it doesn't really mean anything, and it would be quite interesting to see if that would actually be applied to football.
And can you think of any examples, either of you, where, I mean, we talk about game state all the time, so this shouldn't be too difficult, but where it's applied in Leeds games and radically the game has radically changed based on the game state?
I guess a good example would be Liam Cooper getting sent off against Man City. That's kind of game state as well. I think when we're talking about game state, we're just talking about any situation that changes the baseline of what you might expect from a game. So yeah, a player gets sent off, and then you would expect that to have an impact on the way that the opposition are going to play against that 10-man side. Or as Tom said, a goal is a great example of that as well. Once a goal is scored, then oppositions will change the way they play. And so I think for us, we talk about it a lot because when you're analyzing the data, it's important to have those game states in your mind. So as Tom said, you know, if a team sits back on a 1-0, I mean, I guess a great example of that would be the England final where England went 1-0 up and then sat back on their lead. And then I think they conceded close to 3xG off the back of that. And yeah, the reason why that was the case is because they were happy to give Italy a lot of possession, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just a shorthand way of saying, yeah, the data is important, but we need to think about what was going on the field to give a bit of context to that data as well.
Okay, so to end this mammoth trawl through the annals of tactics, we have a final question from Udav Chowan. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Probably haven't. And it is, what tactical changes do you think Bielsa could make in the upcoming season?
So for me, the big question is whether or not we stay as transitional as we have, or whether or not we try and bring in players to maybe control possession a little bit more. That's the most interesting tactical development I think we'll see this season.
For me, it'd be either refining what we saw in the first half of last season, so like being more attacking, probably a little bit more open, but sort of it'd probably be refining the role of one of the eights to sort of make that doable, or we'll double down on the second half of the season, which I really hope doesn't happen, so that we're a bit more solid, a bit less attacking. Yeah, so I think it'll be refine the first one or just be really boring in the second one, which will be horrible. What a great way to end.
Okay, so thanks everyone for listening. If people want to know more about tactics, where should they go, John?
Yeah, I think Twitter's your place. There's plenty of people who are interesting. And the thing that I usually do is find people who are knowledgeable about a single club. If you find that club interesting tactically, then just find those accounts that really cover it. So that's largely what I do. There's books out there as well. A lot of people use Michael Cox's stuff. So he's written a couple of books. One's called The Mixer, one's called Zonal Marking, which was his blog name when he was originally writing tactics stuff. Jonathan Wilson as well has Inverting the Pyramid, which a lot of people see as being quite a seminal work in terms of thinking about how tactics change. And yeah, I guess there's plenty of people writing blogs as well, so that's probably the best way of doing that.
And of course, we're duty bound to say that throughout the season, there will be various interviews with interesting tactics people on our Patreon, which you can sign up to if you go to www.patreon.com/allstatsaren't we. It's not just tactics stuff. There's going to be loads of detailed previews of every game, author's lists every so often. There's going to be all sorts of great, great stuff. And it only costs the price of a pint, as they say. So without further ado, I suppose it's time to say thank you, John.
Thank you.
And thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
And we'll see you all later.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.